Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a return guest, someone I'm looking forward to speaking with, because we had a wonderful conversation about the GAPS diet and the GI tract and how that's integral to health. And we had so much to talk about on that topic that we didn't get to another topic that I think is very timely and important. And that's the topic of toxic homes and mold. I live in the South, and part of our problem down here is the moisture. And I'm seeing patients more and more come into the office with these vague complaints, everything from brain fog to GI problems, and of course, allergy and sinus issues. And I've become more attuned to, we have to think about our environment more. And I don't think we know much about this. So I'm looking forward to speaking today with Ms. Jennifer Scribner. She's a functional nutritional therapy practitioner, a certified GAPS practitioner. She trained under Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride in 2011, and her specialty is helping people learn and follow the GAPS diet to address autism and complex digestive and autoimmune conditions. She's the author of From Mac and Cheese to Veggies, Please, How to Get Your Kid to Eat New Foods and End Picky Eating Forever, and Stay Sane in the Process and the Navigating of GAPS Daily Journal, 90 Days of Tracking Patterns and Progress on the GAPS Nutritional Protocol. And you can go to her website, bodywisdomnutrition.com, to learn more about her and also her work. So, Ms. Scribner, I'm looking forward to our conversation. I want to thank you again for taking the time to come back on.
Thanks. I am really excited to talk about this. These are topics that are really close to my heart and things I've been learning about through personal experience as well.
Well, why don't we start off with your personal experience? What was your entree into this important aspect of our health?
Well, when it came to toxins in the home, I always felt like I was, you know, it was in my awareness. I wanted to live environmentally. I wanted to know about those things. But I didn't really quite understand it because of the greenwashing that goes on in the industry when it comes to products that are used to clean your home and put on your body. I was often choosing things that had a nice sounding name, or it would say natural on the bottle. And when I got into my 30s and I was having my own health issues, and particularly still experiencing acne, I had to kind of take a deeper dive into what that meant for food, but also what that meant for the potential toxic burden that I was exposed to on any given day. And that's when I really kind of dug into the research and started learning that there's more to the story than what shows on the front of the bottle, and that we really have to be critical about what ingredients are actually in the back of the label, and that there's different regulations for products than there are for foods. For example, when something would say natural or organic, that could mean something really different. And that was, you know, when I changed my food, I kind of took the next step and looked at changing my products, and so many of the things that I thought were natural, were healthy for me, that came from, you know, brands that I thought were healthy, like 80% of those things I ended up, you know, throwing away or phasing out over time, and really starting to understand how our skin absorbs things that we're exposed to, and why having things that we could, you know, eat or nearly eat is important to use on our skin and body and in our home environment.
You know, when you say that you're reading these labels and they sound really healthy and we put our trust in them, I would think that organic means that it's safe. It's actually kind of frightening that you really can't read these labels or just look at the label itself and not read the ingredients and hope for the best. I mean, what are some of the things that people need to look out for then? Obviously, it's not the label anymore. What's a couple of ingredients that you should absolutely stay away from?
Well, there's so many, and some of it can depend on the person themselves too. And so to give you one example that I came across, so I thought I was using a natural and healthy toothpaste. And I think it did start out that way, but that smaller brand I had used got bought by a bigger brand, and it was reformatted later. And it included, fluoride, which is something that is not healthy for the thyroid gland, for example. Mm-hmm. It's something that's often in our water as well. And since I was running borderline, you know, low thyroid, that was something that I wanted to avoid in toothpaste, avoid in water, you know, avoid these excess sources, much less it's not something that actually helps us topically in any way as adults. And we're always swallowing a little bit of everything, you know, every time mm-hmm. we brush our teeth, there's that little bit of microingestion. So that was something that was on my radar. But another thing that will come up for people, especially when there is something like canker sores in the mouth or any type of those, you know, sensitivities within the mouth and the gums, is that a lot of people will be sensitive to the ingredient sodium lauryl sulfate or sodium lauryl sulfate. There's kind of two versions of that. And just eliminating that ingredient alone in toothpaste can make a world of difference for people who are, you know, just getting these little mouth sores and they don't know why. And often they feel like it's something related to food, but it turns out it's this thing that they're using twice a day, brushing their teeth, not just the fact that they may be eating citrus or something else like that.
That's really good to know. Actually, I will use that tidbit in my practice, because there are patients that come through, you're not sure exactly what it is, and it's a recurrent issue, but they're otherwise healthy. That's a really good, you know, thank you for that little pearl. You know, it's funny how people just take for granted everything that they're eating, whether that's fast food, whether that's things that they buy over the counter, you know, in the grocery stores. I think a lot more thought has to be put into what we put into our mouths, what we choose to eat. And it's honestly, it's getting tougher. Did you hear that the FDA, I think they've approved this, I guess they're lab-grown meat. Lab-grown mm-hmm. products. I mean, there's no safety, as far as I know, there's no safety profile to these things. No one's ever looked it up. Do you think that this is a very big question, but let's start off. What's your thought about that?
You know, it's interesting you bring up the lab-grown meat, and there's also kind of lab-created dairy products that are on the shelves right now. There are brands that are selling that. And I really went down the rabbit hole on the lab-grown meat thing because I'm really curious about that as an alternative option, about the safety, those type of things. And when you really, really look into it, it's honestly, it just seems like a pipe dream to me. The cost and the environmental resources that are required to create lab-grown meat are just absolutely astronomical. I don't see any way that it can be profitable. And what they're really banking on is some, you know, future technological advances. And so these are things that are being invested in by, you know, tech investors that have absolutely no interest in actual human health and what's really useful for the planet either, because we already have a system of creating meat that is regenerative to this planet, and that is returning cows to actually grazing on grass where they can grow deep roots. The grasses are always in the soil and they are just eaten down and grown again, and the cattle are grazed in a rotation that actually sequesters a ton of carbon. So the environmental aspect of that is just preposterous, but the health impacts, we don't know long term. And there's so many things that have been introduced over the years that were thought to be safe that turned out to not be later. And so to give you one example of that, that's really commonly known to be problematic now, is the herbicide glyphosate. Mm. And so when glyphosate came out and it was, you know, this magical thing that was going to make all the crops so much better, we're going to have, you know, less issues with, you know, weeds in the fields, that type of thing. And when the studies were looked at, there actually isn't a problem with glyphosate in the human body. But where glyphosate is a problem is that it disrupts a certain pathway within our microbiome. So within the gut, the flora that live there, glyphosate impacts that, but not humans directly. Well, as we learn later, you know, in the 1990s, we start doing all this microbiome research. It turns out that glyphosate is damaging our microbiome, and our microbiome is actually connected to our entire body. So we have this cascade of effects that we could not foresee. And so I tend to be very precautionary about any of these kind of technological inventions when it comes to foods, because we all end up being part of a mass experiment with something like this, with these unintended consequences that we, with, you know, for example, with glyphosate, we don't see for, you know, 20 years in some effects. And our children are kind of further harmed as we're you know, procreating, I'm not at our healthiest, that's kind of epigenetically stepping down. And what might be the consequences of that with lab grown meat or dairy or anything in that realm? I'm very cautious about that.
Oh, I don't blame you. And when you think about how you just mentioned how the microbiome is so important, then we're talking about inflammatory bowel disease, about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Do you think there's a connection between those disease states and something that's artificial, man-made, who knows, lab-grown, going into this system?
Absolutely. And, you know, and there's really a case to be made for that in the most sensitive of our clients and patients these days, because you probably see people like this, like I do, where they're, especially children or, you know, sometimes adults as well, they are sensitive to like every food that's known. And I work with certain babies that are FPIs, so food protein intolerance enterocolitis syndrome. So it's basically babies born with like ulcerative colitis. And one thing I've noted with these babies in order to bring them back to health is that we have to get them the most pristine food. And that means food that is on its most natural diet. And one of the ways that we've even accepted that within mass agriculture, even organic, is by feeding poultry, for example, corn or soy, which are not natural to their diet. They're not things they would eat natively. We do the same thing with pork. We do the same thing, of course, with a lot of cattle as well. And when those animals are eating foods that are biologically inappropriate for them, there's something that shows up differently in the meat. What research shows is, yes, there's a different balance of fatty acids and these animals can be under inflammation. But what I see in the people I work with is that they will be highly sensitive to the meat of this animal, but not the meat of the same animal that is raised in its more ancestral way. So it's already happening to the highly sensitive. And I think as these technological, you know, quote unquote solutions come out, it could potentially be a danger to more and more of our population.
Well, I mean, just think of if you think about this in a long-term stand, how many disease processes could actually go even more haywire? Since the gut is so important to our immune system, things like, inflammatory bowel disease, autoimmune disease, everything that food allergy, which is exploding. I can imagine that connection, perhaps, to setting this thing off, like going totally haywire.
Yeah, and we see that especially with things that are, you know, collagen type of disorders that are autoimmune related, or the early onset we're seeing in arthritis and things like that. When we are eating food that is, you know, less than healthy, it is producing less than healthy results in adults. And a lot of that, I think we're seeing more and more because we're having a more toxic start. We're not starting off with, you know, planetarily or food system wise, the thing that my parents even had when they were young, which was more locally grown, more homegrown emphasis, much less industrialized. And even those of us who are trying and are eating industrialized organic, it's a step better, but it's not necessarily what's going to be regenerative. It's not going to be healing, but it's a way better kind of maintenance plan. And that, I think, is something that gets kind of overlooked and can feel overwhelming in our society because it feels so far out of everyday reach for most of us. But to me, that's why I want to share these ideas and hopefully get enough people who are on a healing journey that have enough energy freed up to start really taking actions on these things and demanding better from our systems, rather than saying the status quo is fine at the FDA, but saying we really want something that's healthier. We really demand change in this country.
I agree with you. And I think it starts with the individual. And so as a physician, and, you know, and as a healthcare practitioner yourself, I can't imagine how frustrating it must be to see the movement of the health system towards suppression. Almost every commercial I see on TV is something that's going to suppress the immune system. There's nothing that's about fixing it or getting to the root cause. And honestly, it is what you are, what you eat. And what you just described to me is, if we can just pull ourselves away from this easy fix, take a pill, it'll be okay, and go back to basics, I think we would see a lot less disease. And I think we can have a lot of people recover from this hole that they seem to be going down. and just keep going down, never to recover, never to return.
Yeah. And it really is, you know, that individual awareness, that individual choice. And also we have to shift our own mindset because we now are trained to want that quick fix. Mm-hmm. And nature doesn't work quickly. So when we really start reclaiming our health, we start eating natural foods, we start changing out products in our home, we don't get an overnight success. We don't get results in 2 weeks necessarily. Yes, we may see some, but the long term, it unfolds as things do in nature, where it's going to take some time and it's not going to be exciting every single day. It's really the additive impact of positive nutrition, less toxicity in our environment, working on our own mindsets, making healthy choices with the faith that it is going to lead us to something better without expecting that it's going to be immediate, or if we'll take this, you know, supplement instead of this pill and we're going to feel automatically the same. There's a lot of that. We want to swap it for something more natural, but also have it really fast. And I feel like that's something we need to kind of rewrite within our consciousness and have a realistic expectation of what the human body can do naturally isn't overnight.
No. And it, you know, everything that's worth it does take work, and mm-hmm. it's a process, and it's not, you can do it for a week and then everything is great. It's a lifestyle choice, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's kind of what I try to remind my clients of as well is, you know, like you say, the things that are really worthwhile are generally not quick and easy. You know, if you think about college, if you think about marriage, if you think about your career, there is some level of putting in time and effort and waiting for that payoff and, you know, keeping your eye on that prize. None of that stuff that we hold most valuable is the stuff that comes so easily.
I would absolutely agree. I know we're going to transition to our environment and especially our house. So let's take our first break because I want to make sure we have enough time to speak about mold and toxic homes and what that really means. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Jennifer Scribner. And again, you can go to her website, bodywisdomnutrition.com, to learn about what she does, how she's working with children, her diet, and her blog. And before the break, we were talking about food that we're eating. And that's something that we can have a little bit more control over our choices. But what about our homes? I mean, you think about all the things that go into building the home and the insulation, all these things that potentially can be toxic, and also moisture and mold. I think that people think of mold as really something that you can see or smell, but is it always that way or can it be silent?
It can absolutely be silent. Often there may be clues, but they might be really subtle and it's easy to overlook them and it's easy to want to turn a blind eye because I think we all have this fear that when we open that can of worms, it's really going to be a huge hassle. And honestly, sometimes it is, but it's not an ignorance is bliss situation because it can have really serious health impacts on people, whether they, you know, have awareness of it or not. And so this is one of those things that when people are doing the right things, you know, they're really making those efforts to eat healthy and, you know, keep their homes non-toxic, and they're still not seeing forward movement, or they feel like they really hit a plateau. This is always something I circle back to with them and say, is there any possibility of this? Can we do a testing to rule this out? Could there be a potential hidden source? And many people say, oh, I think that there is in this one area, but I just haven't had, you know, the will to address it. But some people really don't know. And it's only through like a dust sample test that they might identify that there is an issue and then have to kind of pull in the clues from there as to finding the source of it.
So when you say dust sample, that means it's not on a surface. It's actually airborne then, right?
Yeah. So there's something that's called ERMI testing, E-R-M-I, and that is taking like a Swiffer and essentially collecting dust samples from a certain, you know, area in your house or one floor of your home and finding what is circulating, what is settled. And that, so sometimes it may be, for instance, in somebody's HVAC system. And so they're not seeing a specific active growth, but they find that there are spores or mycotoxins all over their home because of that. And it may not have had a smell, it may not have been obvious, but this can identify that type of growth.
Interesting. So let's say you are exposed to mycotoxins. What makes them so toxic, for lack of a better way to put it, as opposed to just an allergy to dust or to pet dander? What turns on the immune response with them to such a degree?
Well, like with anything, it depends on the person too, because not everybody has the same sensitivity level, and it can trigger different things in different people. And so I don't know, there's a lot of talk about it, and I don't know that it's more toxic per se than other types of toxins. It's more that certain people are sensitive and it's largely overlooked. And one of the issues is that it doesn't just get washed away, and that when mold is, you know, quote unquote killed, it doesn't mean that the toxins are gone. And so often people will think, oh, I saw some mold and I sprayed something on it and therefore it's dead and gone. But the toxins actually will persist even within the material that is left around. Even when it has been, you know, quote unquote sprayed and kind of killed or sanitized, the mold spores themselves are separate from the toxins that they make. And so that's what makes it so tricky, and also that it's microscopic or, you know, invisible to the naked eye. And so we aren't always seeing what the impacted area is. And so if you're just cleaning that one windowsill that seems to clean mold, thinking that you're taking care of the problem, that might not actually be the case. There could be mold growth that's hidden in the wall, or there could be also these airborne mycotoxins that are all over the couch and the dining room and circulating on an ongoing basis that you're just unaware of.
So I've had patients who've had mold toxic homes and they moved, but they brought their furniture and their clothing with them, and it ended up not fixing their symptoms. So if it can be in the covering of your couch and in your clothing, is that something that you recommend that people do? Do they need to go to that level to get rid of stuff too?
In general, yeah. And particularly if the health of the people in the family is really severe. So when I'm working with kids who have, you know, major autoimmune conditions, where they have, you know, specifically immune deficiency type of diseases, kids that have really severe autism symptoms. In those cases, it's like, leave it all behind because they are so severely impacted. Now, if someone's just like, oh, I think I have a little mold, but we're generally all feeling healthy, and, you know, let me see if I can clean up this area. When it is through the HVAC system, it tends to be over everything, and it's honestly safer to kind of start from scratch. Mm-hmm. But find out what type of mold that might be too, because not all of them are the similar levels of toxicity as well. And that needs to be identified. And that's what a dust test can kind of help you do. But in general, when it is widespread like that, I think that that makes the most sense. If it's something that's really isolated and hasn't been super airborne, you may be able to just, you know, carefully remediate that bathroom without replacing everything in the home. But the safe side is always leaving it behind. And it's so painful to do that. I have a client recently, they've just, you know, bought a home, bought all new furnishings, turned out that there was mold in the HVA system. They've spent all this money. It was their dream, their family, and they had to really walk away from all of it, you know, and it's painful financially and from mementos and things like that too, that they just don't feel safe to bring mm-hmm. because the health of their son is so jeopardized right now.
That's really tragic. Do you see, you know, you've been doing this for a while, are you seeing an increase in this type of problem?
You know, I think it's come into my awareness more partly because we have experienced mold in our own home. And so as I've shared about that, I think I've attracted more people into my practice that are experiencing that. And they kind of know that I have some, you know, personal identification. But it's something I've seen throughout time with my clients. And like I said before, it's really that kind of thing where it's like, oh, you have Crohn's disease and, you know, you're 60% better, but something's really just not, you know, completely crossing over to get you that next level. Or for people that have those chronic sinus infections, mm-hmm. they've had sinus surgeries and it hasn't helped. Mm-hmm. It's always like, okay, what's going on in the home? That's where we want to see it. When somebody is experiencing Lyme disease, it's always another test I want them to run, because certain things, bleeding, eczema, there's a handful of conditions that to me, there's always a red flag. Like, we need to double check that. People who are debilitated by dysautonomia or, you know, nervous system conditions to the point where they can't work. These are things I want to rule out. So I do find that more common, but it may just be that it's more in my awareness than it was early in my practice.
Is it something like for someone suffering from Pott's disease, is that a patient that you would want to look into this type of exposure?
Yeah, especially if it seems like something shifted, you know, specifically when they moved to a place, or for people who tell me that they feel good when they leave their house and they're always sick at home. That to me is always a flag, because you can pass it off as like, oh, that was a vacation, so I was more relaxed. But that doesn't always give you the whole explanation, especially when it is you went on a work trip and you still felt better. It wasn't just that, you know, trip to Mexico that made you feel better. Those are times where I really want people to at least rule that out. And it's not always an issue, but it feels better to rule it out than to wonder and know that there could be something that's kind of like festering there.
Totally.
Especially something non-food that can be addressed. Sometimes that's honestly easier and a relief.
I got you. So my next corollary to that question is, when they do have the exposure, what happens when you clean out everything? All right, first of all, is there a company, or I know you mentioned getting a sample of a dust sample. Is there a company that you'd recommend to actually get it tested? Because that's really hard. People have asked me and I don't exactly know where to send them. You send them online, but who knows, you know, if they're all created equally.
Yeah. So I work with people all over the country as well. And so if people are self-ordering online, I have been recommending Envirobiomics, and they have a pretty easy to use interface. There's pretty clear ordering instructions if you want to get the ERMI dust testing. But I also encourage people to look locally for a mold inspector that could help them find the source. If it looks like there is, you know, if there is an issue and you want to get that checked out, that's what we did. We had an area where we suspected in our bathroom that was moldy. And so we actually had someone come out and they brought moisture meters that they could put on the wall, as well as different, you know, swab samplings of the mold that was found, which is different than a dust sample. Mm-hmm. So there are different things to look at there. And I generally recommend that people find a mold inspector who is separate from a mold remediator, because the remediator might be kind of looking for problems that they want to solve for people, because that can be, you know, a financial boon to them. Mm-hmm. And different states have different laws about if the person has to be separate for an inspector and a remediator. And I think it's just safer to have a inspector who is separate, and also an inspector who is familiar with what's called CIRS, chronic inflammatory response syndrome. They're more likely to have a just higher standard of the mold that they're looking at, what might be safe, what might not be safe, rather than kind of brushing it off and be like, oh, that's no big deal, that can just be cleaned up, but really taking it seriously, understanding the great health impacts that it could be having.
That's an excellent point. And for those who live in apartment buildings, that's another issue, that they don't control their living space and they have the management come in. And I've heard stories where, oh yeah, you have mold, but they just paint over it as if that's supposed mm-hmm. to be the end all be all. Just for those people, I have to ask the question. I think I know the answer, but is painting over something really the answer? Do you have to rip out the wall and start over?
Yeah, and it's kind of tricky. I mean, I almost feel like in a rental, it's kind of easier because you can pick up and leave easier than when you own your house. Because when you own it, you're on the hook for all of it. But I will also say, when we were looking through mold remediation products, you will find reviews from people online who are apartment managers and say, oh yeah, I cleaned this and we passed that mold inspection test without doing remediation. And remediation means that they are removing the infected, impacted materials. So that means taking out the drywall and sanitizing any of the beams that cannot be removed, and then putting on new, making sure that it's dry, and, you know, fixing any leaks that may have happened. It would also include removing the carpet, not just running a carpet cleaner over the impacted area. And so it's complicated like that. And that's one of the things, like, I have a client right now who's looking for a new apartment, and she has than doing the ERMI testing when she does an apartment walkthrough before she puts in her application, that she does it and puts it on a rush turnaround to try to find out, is there actually hidden mold in this apartment, because she's really impacted by it. So if it's serious, you kind of have to take those more serious, and it can be costly, but it's better to be safe in these situations.
I agree. You don't want to be in a position where you have to get rid of everything that you love. So we talked now about the environment. What happens after you've been mold exposed? Do you actually have to detox yourself? So it's actually inundating your system. Is that a thing?
Yeah. And the thing is that it puts a lot of burden on your own detoxification system, and it tends to back up kind of the processes that are happening in your liver. And it's, again, this is not something that can be done all at once, or it's not like, oh, I moved out of that place and 2 days later I felt better because I stopped the exposure. It's really about supporting your body to make sure that those detoxification processes are online, and that you are, we always talk about your pathways being open. So are you pooping? Are you peeing? Are you sweating? Making sure that things can leave your body effectively. And then there may be binders that can be useful. I think infrared sauna is very useful for people who've had mold exposure. And then just good nutrient-dense food, because detoxification is a nutrient-driven process. And so making sure that there's a focus on that, and that you're avoiding other things that could be inflammatory or other chemicals that might be bogging you down, but really knowing that it's going to be kind of like a day-to-day, slow over time detoxification.
Well, when you say, using supplements and using your diet, are there foods you need to stay away from for us when we ask patients to avoid certain foods if they're allergic, like for mold, for example? We ask patients to stay away from things like almonds and watermelon and coffee and things that are actually can cross-react from an allergic standpoint. Is that something that exists in this detox mechanism as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one thing I find is when people have been living in a moldy environment, that they will be hypersensitive to things smelling like mold. And so that's one of my kind of most useful things that I tell people is, if you open something, or if you choose something at the grocery store, like say you pick up some mushrooms and they smell moldy, or you open a can of sauerkraut, which is something that I'm always advocating that people eat fermented foods. But if you open something and you smell a whiff of it and it's moldy to you, avoid it. Don't ask other people what they think about it, because they're not going to have the hypersensitivity level that when it's within your body, you're going to notice that immediately. You're going to be the one who shows up at the cabin that you rented, immediately walk in and be like, ooh, it smells musty in here. And other people might not notice it. Trust your body in those situations, as well as avoiding the things that are often contaminated. Things like peanuts that generally have mold on them are also wise.
Okay, that sounds like an excellent plan. Any problems with drinking alcohol, like wine, for example?
I am not a huge fan of people drinking in general when they're trying to heal, because things that are intoxicating, it's right there in the word, it's a toxin. And we want to take a break from toxins while we are allowing the detoxification system to kind of catch up. So I feel like limiting that is really important. And on the subject of wines and alcohols, they are really similar to perfumes, where they can have 25 things on the label and they are in the ingredients, but it doesn't have to be on the label because it's considered proprietary and generally safe. So that can be a whole other subject to be really cautious about, and making sure that you are, if you are drinking, that you're choosing a really natural wine. That is the term that describes natural in the winemaking industry, or really vetting the company that you're looking at buying from to make sure that it is, a pure product, not a concoction, essentially, with red dyes to make the, color you expect of that type of wine, for example.
I had no idea all that stuff went on with winemaking. To make it, that sounds horrible. It's like the food coloring to make the meat look red. I didn't know they did that in wines as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's part of why people will feel so ill easily from certain wines, and the quality can really matter. And it's not about expense by any means. It's about the quality and the naturalness of the processing versus the kind of lab concoction. And it's just like anything. We envisioned natural winemaking, you know, people stomping with their feet in a, you know, large barrel with grapes, and then that's fermenting. And that's not how it's really made today for the most part. It's also really industrialized.
It's really scary. I mean, it's like you have to grow it yourself and have a direct connection with a farmer and know exactly where your food's coming from. It's this supply chain is affecting not only products, but our food supply as well. And I can only imagine whatever else they're going to try to put in, as we talked at the beginning of the show with this lab grown meat. I can only imagine what they're going to try to put into it to make it look real, taste good. It's just, it doesn't, it's not food, basically.
Yeah. And why have the simulation when we do have the original ideas that we can go with? And we have to be willing to pay what those things cost. We have to be able to respect our food, respect the people who are raising that food for us. And I'm a huge advocate of knowing at least some of the people who are producing your food. You know, it's really difficult to know all of it, but you know, there are people who are raising food all over the country. And if it's just a handful of things you're getting at a farmer's market where you can visit, you can talk to that person. If it's, you know, raw milk that you're seeking, or you're getting a meat share, that you have that direct connection, you're going to know, and they're usually going to take a lot of pride in, you know, you bought this cow, that's the cow you're getting. You're not getting 500 cow crunched up into some ground meat and then all mixed up together. And those things can really, that transparency to me makes a difference, and it's making the world that I want to live in when it comes to food that supports human health.
I absolutely applaud that. So from a consumer standpoint, you're really very savvy. Is there someplace people need to start so they can start accessing this side of our food system? Because it exists. It's like a parallel system, but everything's in your face. You know, the people with the money, with the ability to advertise on TV, seem to have the whole market. So you're not aware of other things. How can people start the process of looking for family farms, having shares, really getting involved? And actually, I think it's cheaper a lot of the times when you actually have this one-on-one relationship.
Yeah, that's my experience, especially in the last few years, where when I'm buying farm direct, it's actually per pound more affordable, and I'm able to get the cuts that I wouldn't buy at the store. You know, if it's a $30 a pound steak or something, I'd be like, nah, I'll get something cheaper. But I get a whole variety when I get a part of a cow share, for example. So there's a number of ways that you can start finding food like this. And the simplest and the most direct is often if there's a farmer's market in your area, to go there and, you know, speak with someone, and they might be selling things by the cut there, but do they offer shares? Do they offer farm tours? Do they, you know, want to offer different products that maybe they don't bring to that farmer's market? So that's a way that you can go and kind of meet different people directly and see what's available. There are also organizations that you can look through. Like I really appreciate the work that the Weston A. Price Foundation does. They put together a shopping guide every year for their members that is actually a physical booklet, and it's all divided up by different types of food. And so you can look through there and you can find producers in your state or in your area. And you can even find things that are mail order if it's not someone really local to you, but you could have a direct relationship. And then there's also another website called the Good Meat Project that connects producers directly to consumers, as well as people who want to produce their own food. You know, often they'll be like, okay, we have chicks for sale, or, you know, pigs for sale or something, if people are wanting to get into raising their food. But those are a few places to start. And now it can even be as simple as just kind of doing a search engine near you and looking for organic farm or, you know, meat share. It's kind of knowing some of those search terminologies that you can put in and see what comes up.
Well, I think there's also vegetables as well. So it's not just meat, right? It's everything from even soap, even natural products to clean. It's like everything, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's why I like farmers markets, because you can meet people and, you know, they're within a drive of you, so you know that they can't be terribly far away. You might also find things at a local co-op, if there's a food co-op near you. And then it may be that there are you know, community supported agriculture that have the like vegetable and fruit box shares. I'm also seeing that coming up for fisheries and seafood now, wow, where you can kind of become a member and you can get a variety of products from people. And similarly with it's expanding more and more. There may be honey, there may be locally produced olive oils if that's available in your area. There can be nuts, there can be so many things. And then people who are producing soaps, or maybe they have goat milk and they're making goat milk soaps. And you can really, I mean, I love supporting a regional economy and knowing that my stuff doesn't have to travel super far to get to me either.
Right.
But then finding people who care about that quality.
Now, when you think about this in the macro picture, that supply chain, which is very fragile, this bypasses that because it's local. So your own micro economy, where you're not depending on it coming out from another country or across the country, it just gives you a lot more peace of mind that you won't have to be disrupted in case something does happen, right?
Yeah. And when we look at things today, like China is raising chickens for us and shipping them over here on boats. I mean, it's just so ridiculous to mm-hmm. me, whereas the chickens that are raised for me by a family farm 1 hour away from me, and yes, they, you know, raising animals can have its own issues. They may have losses and that sort of thing, but I have a personal connection with them. And I know that I'm kind of like on the list that they're planning for, that they're raising for me. And they have the security of knowing that I am going to be a buyer and that I want them to continue raising and that I'm supporting those standards. And then if there is shops are closed or who knows what the next disruption might be, I still have access to going to that farm and picking that up. You know, we have that agreement. And to me, that creates a food security mm-hmm. that is kind of opting out of the mainstream grocery systems. And I know that that's something people have a lot of concern about these days, and, you know, food storage and food security. And rather than only stocking up on, you know, freeze-dried foods, getting to know the producers around you, supporting them now so that they will still exist in these times that might be hardships for the rest of the world. Like, I want to know that there are people that can make a living and that can continue to do these things sustainably. And I'm willing to invest in that now to assure that that's going to be available no matter what comes later.
I couldn't have said it better. On that note, let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Jennifer Scribner. And before the break, we talked a lot about everything, which is really important. It's just taking this big picture approach. It makes it so much less intimidating. And before we started talking about the food, I wanted to backtrack a bit to mold. Is there a connection? And I'm just curious, because everybody's wired with 5G, wireless, this and this. Does that affect mold growth or the I wouldn't know the toxic level, but at least the mold inflammation level on the body?
It seems to, yeah. And I'm not really super educated in this area, but I've definitely heard talk about that, and that there can be an increase with those things together, that there is some sort of influence there. And that can be another area where people can be affected by something that is a toxin in the home. Maybe they don't have mold, but maybe they have a lot of exposure to electromagnetic radiation, either within the home or outside the home, depending on where you live, what's available in your neighborhood, if you're in an apartment building with, you know, towers attached to it, that type of thing. So that in it is a whole other level of stressor to the body that it can be too much. You know, there's so many different factors there. And particularly when these things get stacked upon each other, if you have potentially mold in your home, you have, you know, a cell phone tower next door, or 5Gs are going up on your buildings, and you also have, you know, toxic dryer sheets that you're using in your own home, or you're burning scented candles all the time, these things are all additive, just like healthy choices are all additive. And so sometimes it can be that one thing that kind of broke the camel's back that pushes you into really poor health, and needing to mitigate many of those things is actually what brings you back into balance.
It's really, again, the more you think about this, the more everything that's convenient seems to be, you know, a positive and a negative. And you really have to start weighing them, because at some point, you're right, you end up having more negatives than you do positives, and you've just on a disease track at that point, you know, is the first thing that people who aren't feeling well, you know, honestly, listen to your body. I would think that's the first thing. What about a relationship with your physician or your practitioner? How does this play a role in it? I mean, these diseases that you've just, that we've talked about are very difficult to treat. They require time to listen to the patient, to actually make a differential. Do you think that the patients, and I think I know the answer, but how did this affect the patients with these complex diseases? Because the healthcare system is based on a 7-minute in and out, give a prescription. Do the patients need to want more? Do they need to look for someone like yourself, somebody who can look at the whole body on a cellular level and have the tools to actually not poo-poo the patient? Because I would think a lot of the people who come to see you must be extremely frustrated because they've been pushed off as some, it's psychological, you don't really have it, get out of my office, you know, that kind of attitude.
Yeah, and sometimes it's just like, well, this is all we can offer you, and that's not acceptable to the person. And they're like, I just can't believe that I am supposed to live with this. I believe that there is another answer, and, you know, they're willing to find it. They're willing to have faith that that exists. And so I think it can be complementary, and it can sometimes people opt out entirely, but there's always another option. That's what I encourage people. There's always another layer. It's not a linear process where you only do one thing and that leads to this. You know, with the body, there are these multiple layers. So having a practitioner that you feel like you really mesh with is important. I know for me, when I'm having an intake session with somebody, we're talking for an hour and a half. Sometimes I'm the first person that's listened to their whole story, and that in itself is therapeutic. Just to feel like you've been heard, that you aren't crazy, that you believe that their health can be turned around. You know, for me, I have ultimate faith in the human body, and I believe that there is a blueprint that we are endowed with, that the body is self-healing. And so I'm not afraid of, you know, certain conditions that other people would say are incurable. I'm like, I can't say it, you know, anything can be cured, but I believe that the body can always be bettered. And I believe that about every single condition, no matter how, you know, severe, genetic, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that there's always something better. And my belief and the belief that you have about your own quality of care and the practitioner that you work with, maybe that's a placebo effect, is just the belief. But I think we should use that to our advantage. And so having any type of practitioner that you feel like you really resonate with, that you really have faith in, and they have faith in you, is a healing relationship and a potential for healing in your condition.
I think that's very hopeful. And that to me is what real healthcare is about. It's about what you can do, not the limitations. What, you know, there's abundance and there's possibility, and everybody's different. And I think the way you approach it is positive, and that's the beginning of healing. I think that's the crux of what it should be. Now, we don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to go back to talk about a bit the gut and psychology syndrome, what we call GAPS. And there's so many diseases that are kind of nebulous. Some of the things that I've gone on your website, and things that the GAPS diet might help, are things that are like hormonal imbalances, which seem to be kind of running rampant. People getting their periods early, you know, they're, from women's standpoint, men with low testosterone levels. Are these things that, instead of jumping on a hormone medication bandwagon, is that something that the diet could affect?
Yes, absolutely. Because there's the role of inflammation that can be happening in the body that can disrupt our hormones. So there's also the role that the gut actually plays, and our gut flora plays, in helping making these hormones, making different, you know, hormone supports, nutrients that are used within our hormonal system. So I believe diet plays a really big role in that. And also the foods that we're eating that provide the raw materials to make our hormones. So if you're not, for example, eating a healthy amount of cholesterol, that's the backbone to all of our sex hormones, to all of our, you know, hormones, our vitamin D, all of that. So we need to make sure that that's in the diet. And so if you've been on a low fat diet for a long term, or you have, you know, cholesterol lowering medications that you've been taking, and you're experiencing these type of, you know, sex hormone issues, those things can go hand in hand. And so how do we support that nutritionally so that your body just has these raw materials to make hormones. But the other thing I think plays a really big role that the GAPS protocol addresses, but often people only think of the dietary aspect, but we also really encourage people to be out in nature, to be out in sunlight, to be kind of communing with the elements, because there's a huge role that being a part of nature's cycles on a day-to-day basis plays in our hormonal regulation as well. And I think that's often overlooked, and it's really easy to live a largely indoor lifestyle or to avoid the sun or to be wearing sunscreen or hats and things all the time and to not get the appropriate exposure to our skin, our eyes, that also help regulate these systems.
Interesting. So with sun exposure, the first thing I think about is vitamin D. Is that something that's integral in this, in health?
Absolutely. And there's so many things. I'm actually currently writing an article about sensible sun exposure, talking about vitamin D, but also talking about the, you know, what vitamin D does in the body that's beneficial towards autoimmunity, towards cancer prevention, towards our immune system in general and boosting that. But there are other aspects of the sun, for instance, the creation of something called cholesterol sulfate that is also known to be supportive of, you know, lowering inflammation in the body, regulating the immune system. There's much more to it than just vitamin D. There are ways that that impacts the microbiome itself. So getting sun on your belly can actually help your digestive issues. Like there's a plethora of things that the sun provides that aren't only vitamin D, but definitely including that. And one of the things about sun exposure for vitamin D is that 100% of the vitamin D that you make on your skin gets utilized in your body because it gets bound to its receptor. Whereas even when you take a supplement, you're getting about 60% of that, and 40% of it just can't be used because oral ingestion isn't as effective. And when you get it through the sun as well, you can't get too much vitamin D through the sun. Your body will actually not allow that to happen. It will just degrade anything extra. So you can't overdose the way you can on supplements. So I'm a huge proponent of sun exposure and actually getting as much of our vitamin D as we can through natural sun.
Imagine all the people who didn't go out during the COVID, height of COVID. I can imagine you're just like a hermit in your house and then no sun exposure, not bad enough you're not meeting with people and communing with other humans. But I mean, we really set ourselves back, it sounds like, from a health perspective over these last several years.
Yeah, and I was very critical of these requirements to stay indoors entirely. I just thought that was ridiculous, especially you might be stuck indoors in a home that has mold, that has, you know, toxic off-gassing, like that may not actually be a healthy place for you. And then you're also not getting sun exposure. And of course, when we're outdoors, we're more likely to be getting physical activity that also boosts our mood, that helps with, you know, the avoidance of anxiety and depression. Like there's so many layers to that that are really important that I think led to the degradation and the vulnerability of people towards illness because of that, you know, avoidance of others and avoidance of the sun and of being outdoors.
So from the child standpoint, the learning and social issues that we see running rampant in the schools, I'd like to speak to that for a second. It's such a complex thing. I mean, social cues, not being with your classmates, etc. But how is the diet playing a role in social problems and learning disabilities that seem to have really grown and mushroomed since kind of for a while now, but definitely over the last 3 years?
Yeah. And again, I mean, I think there's something that's really grown over time because of nutritional deficiencies and even looking at what's, you know, allowed and required in the school lunch programs. Tons of sugar, lack of natural animal fats, which provide our raw materials for our feel-good kind of chemicals, neurotransmitters, hormones to be made. So when kids are lacking cholesterol, they're lacking things like egg yolks, they're not getting vitamin A, they're not getting vitamin D from food in the winter, you know, a pork lard, cooking with that is a great source of vitamin D for the winter. These are things that have fallen out of fashion. And when we are eating kind of industrialized foods in their place, we're adding things that are inflammatory that can cause disruption in the brain, disruption in within the neurotransmitter system. And so it's not like it's just the lack, it's also that the replacement creates problems. And so it's, you know, more than there's like a couple layers to this that can go on top of each other. And I think that that's something that's just been degrading over time, just with the kind of industrialization of our food. And one of the things that I've seen, you know, when kids return to school after COVID is that they don't allow homemade snacks anymore, that that's deemed dangerous. So people are bringing in even more industrialized little packets of food snacks that they want the kids to eat that are going to be, you know, worse for health than something that is at least made from scratch, even if it isn't the most pristine ingredient.
It seems like everything we try to do to make it easier on ourselves in the end makes it harder for our body and our brain to work the way it's designed. You know, time goes way too fast, but I want to make sure people know how to get your books, how to read your blogs, and how to interact with you.
Yeah, thank you. My website at bodywisdomnutrition.com is the best place to find me, to find access to all of those things. I'm over 120 blog posts at least that I've published. I also have a newsletter that's an option there. I'm semi-active on Instagram as well, but the main repository of information about the GAPS diet and other topics I write about on health are at bodywisdomnutrition.com.
I really enjoyed our conversation. I learned a great deal, and I would love to have you come back to speak on any other topic you'd like.
Thanks so much. Yeah, it's been fun.
Well, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.